Welcome to the Innovation Station, the new podcast from the Innovation Hub of South Yorkshire and Bassalaw, ICS. This is your quick roundup of health and care innovation within our region and beyond, where we discuss some of the challenges facing the health and care system and highlight how innovation, technology, and new ideas are transforming and improving services to help address these challenges. The Innovation Hub is a partnership between the Yorkshire and Humber Academic Health Science Network and the South Yorkshire and Bassalaw Integrated Care System. The Innovation Hub works to help the ICS identify unmet needs from across the health and care sector and support the adoption and spread of innovation which can help meet these needs. I'm your host, Ijaz Zahid, Program Director of the Innovation Hub. So in today's podcast, we're going to talk about innovative ways in which social media can support healthcare services to be more effective. For many social media users, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, etc., have become both key sources of healthcare information and a means to connect with others experiencing similar health needs. For example, during the pandemic, while health services and healthcare researchers were still in the process of gathering evidence around effective treatments for long COVID, many sufferers of the condition who couldn't afford to wait and needed help now turned to social media to connect with each other, to share knowledge around what may or may not have worked for them. These DIY communities have proven to be a life raft for many. On the flip side, the last decade or so has seen a rising tide of misinformation across social media sites, to the degree where many people now feel that finding the truth can be a needle in a haystack exercise, and that social media is in fact becoming a major tool for public manipulation. This has been most evident in politics, given scandals such as Cambridge Analytica, but as we've seen during the pandemic, increasingly healthcare is becoming a major victim of this infodemic, where all sorts of false stories, conspiracy theories relating to, for example, the dangers of 5G masks, vaccines, anti-masking have been proliferating. This is not new, however, because beyond the pandemic, there are countless snake oil merchants spreading misleading health information, which can range from harmless baldness cures all the way through to downright dangerous, bogus cancer treatments. At the South Yorkshire and Bassalaw ICS Innovation Hub, we feel the health sector can no longer afford to ignore this and must engage in a proactive way to not only counter harmful and potentially life-threatening misinformation in a timely manner, but also use the vast digital toolkits that come with social media to, on the contrary, use this unprecedented resource and asset for good. In our virtual studio today, we have colleagues from the University of Leeds with whom we've been collaborating over the last year to study how misinformation in healthcare is impacting our community. And one of the most enterprising and innovative GPs in South Yorkshire, who sees tremendous potential in some of the benefits social media can provide in healthcare if done right. Welcome, Serge, Christine, Suad from the University of Leeds. Would you like to introduce yourself? Serge, would you like to go first?
Hello, thanks Ajaz for inviting us. So I'm Serge Sharoff from the University of Leeds, and my field is research on language. And more specifically, I investigate data science with language. And one example of what language gives us, it gives us the power to communicate. Every second, we have several hundred messages appearing on Facebook. And the same applies to other communication channels. And there are various interesting things you can do while you have access to this amount of linguistic data in a range of languages and used for a range of purposes.
Thank you, Serge. Christina?
I'm Christina Phillips. I'm a visiting research fellow at Leeds University, and I'm also a business analytics senior lecturer at Liverpool John Moores University. I was really pleased to be asked to be on this project, as we were purposefully using a human-centred design approach to try and include and engage the public within the design of the work that we were doing, to make sure that we were actually taking account of all of the cultural levers that are involved in this kind of work, as well as the actual data that's going through that we're looking at.
Thank you, Christina. And Suad?
I'm Suad Bameshal, a visiting postdoctoral fellow in the School of Languages, Cultures and Societies at University of Leeds, where I teach linguistics, the scientific study of human language, its properties, how it is acquired and how it is learnt, and how it is used to communicate. I'm also involved in different research projects, such as the COVID misinformation project, and how it is circulating on social media.
Thank you, Suad. And finally, Ben.
Sure, yeah. So my name is Dr. Ben Allen. I'm a GP. I work at Burley Health Centre, and I've just recently become the clinical director for primary care in Sheffield. I'm particularly passionate about just patients getting great quality care and a really great experience, and communication is just absolutely central, and also involving patients in helping shape the service, and expert patients helping other patients. So communication is just central.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to have you all in the studio with us today. Our Leeds University colleagues have been studying how we can counter misinformation in healthcare on social media. Can I start with you, Serge? Could you tell us a bit about the project and the team?
About a year ago, we started our project aimed at understanding the nature of communication about COVID. And initially, we set this up as a study of scientific communication, how it shapes the policymakers and the communication they send to the general public, and then how this is all discussed on the web. And we found that there is obviously a disconnect between the kind of the language which is used by the researchers. They talk, for example, about the instantaneous penetration levels of face masks for nanoparticle-sized viruses. And this is not the language which is used by the policymakers or by the general public. But this kind of language is backed up by rigorous research. And in turn, the other kind of language which circulates on social media, and it's not right to say that everything we can see on social media is misinformation. Actually, as one of the recent outcomes of this project, we can say that even when we try monitoring specifically for misinformation, we look into the corners of the web which are aimed at misinformation. Only probably 1/4 of communication we capture is misinformation, right? But at the same time, it emerged while we were doing the first part of the project that misinformation is extremely important. We decided to focus on this specific aspect. And for this, we have got funding, and this enabled us to continue this project with a fantastic team.
Right. So thank you, Serge. I think you might have answered part of my next question, which is about how the idea for the project came into being. Christina, is there any more you'd like to add to that?
When the project first was mooted, I believe it was one of the university's initiatives that brought together Sergey, Neil, and Gary Graham. Neil is from policy research and Gary Graham is from business research. And they kind of came up with this idea of looking in this way. And Sergey was already doing work in that area. And this is how it started to come together. And one of the things that Gary put across was work that he's been doing with me, which is on human-centered design. And he really wanted to try to bring in this aspect of human-centered design in what we were doing, so that we didn't actually ignore the public discourse that was going on around these issues, but we tried to bring it into everything that we were doing so that it would inform the way that we were doing the research. From a design perspective, this was challenging. I brought things in that I know from operational research and from my area of work, which is in human-centred design of analytics. And we went round and round and round many, many times before we actually got into our first workshop with the public, because we wanted to be sure that we got the best information from those engagement exercises. And we also wanted to ensure that we were able to continue it as an ongoing engagement exercise rather than a we talk to you, we take your data, we go away and do things with it, but rather a process which actually had engagement embedded within it. And I think it has been, I would say, tremendously successful in informing the way that we've actually designed the algorithms and the things that we've done with it and the information that we've found as well.
Thanks, Christina. So Suad, it would be great to hear what platforms you were capturing some of the data from and how that data was taken from those sources and utilized.
I think to better understand how COVID misinformation flow and the types of, let's say, the narratives and the stories circulating among social media users, we tried to test first Twitter. So we collected data from Twitter, and then we moved to Telegram and then Facebook. So these platforms, they tend to have slightly different content and messaging styles, and they tend to target different groups. So, for example, while Twitter messages are fairly short and they often convey users' perceptions and experiences, Telegram and Facebook messages, they are longer, they are multimodal, so they have a lot of videos, they have a lot of memes, and which tend to capture people's a lot. They are less supervised as well. They are often politically charged, and that was a key point in our project. Our crucial aim in this project is to understand the correlation between particular socio-demographic factors and key features of the message, and how maybe this kind of promotes the circulation of COVID misinformation. So we wanted to know, is there a relationship between misinformation about, for example, vaccines and specific age groups or specific beliefs? So I think the platforms that we explored and we tested in this project, Twitter, Telegram, and Facebook, allowed us to gain a better understanding on this.
So what is your end goal when you're finding these correlations between specific demographics and the type of misinformation that's proliferating in those communities? How would you go about using this information in the long term?
The end goal was to kind of understand the characteristics of the messages, the topics that are circulating, and who are the people sharing this information. So if we can identify, for example, specific groups, for example, age groups that are more vulnerable to misinformation, then we can suggest this to policy maker, to the health sector, to tailor-made their messages to kind of address this problem and know how to reach these most vulnerable people. We also looked at the gender, for example, people with specific ideological affiliation. We looked at the far right accounts. The aim is to kind of design communication to better reach to those people.
Thank you. Thank you. When it comes to public health communications, we often find ourselves on the back foot, addressing the fallout from misinformation after it has already done significant damage. It sounds like your work can help us become a lot more preemptive in our approach and try to counter false narratives before they get a chance to proliferate. How do you see some of the research you've conducted so far could help develop tools which could empower the health service and in particular communications teams in this regard?
We did have a meeting with communicators in the NHS, and the interesting thing that we found there is a process that needs to take place within the various different health boards and those who deal with communication, where there is a root and branch examination of the processes that take place before communication goes out. Because basically people were caught on the back foot, they were putting out messages, but because they had to go through so many different gating procedures before they were actually put out onto social media, what would often happen was that the message that was the right message was being put out after all the misinformation has gone. So I think it was one of our participants in one of our groups who actually said the misinformation has always already spread while the truth is still getting its trousers on. Basically, it means that we're playing a game of catch up. And so in order to deal with this new landscape, there actually needs to be a root and branch reform within the health services to actually see how they can use this kind of information to be more preemptive, to be faster in their communication of messages. But of course, what we're finding is incredibly useful to them, because they can then find out, well, which demographic groups are likely to pick this up fastest? Who do we need to aim our messages at first? Because who's most likely to start spreading this information? What key hashtags or triggers could we put into our messages that would help us to then spread to these groups so that we can spread our message faster, and so that we can at least try to counteract the narrative in some way and actually get that narrative to become something that is actually more positive?
Great, great. Yes, definitely. And I understand, Serge, that there's an element of artificial intelligence and machine learning in what you're doing. How will that result in the shape of the sorts of tools that you're proposing could be developed for the use of the health services?
Oh, yes, definitely. This is the prime example of how artificial intelligence is useful for the general public. Because what SOAD did was analysis of a sample of several hundred messages. There are millions of messages appearing on the web all the time. So essentially, the way artificial intelligence works is by detecting some patterns which are associated with the messages we know. So we know that some messages came from the younger generation, some messages came from the older generation. We know that some are examples of misinformation, some not. We also know that some messages, they look like newspaper reports. Some messages, they look like personal stories. And some messages, they look like academic research. And this is known for a sample. And on the basis of this sample, we can train classifiers in order to predict for any other message whether this message is coming from a younger or an older person, whether it looks like academic research article or news reporting or a personal story, etc. And then this means that the AI tools can classify whatever content is coming from various sources. So our job is doing research, and at the same time, we are very happy to show the outcomes of these studies to people like you or Ben, as well as communicators in the NHS, telling them that, for example, a younger generation is less likely to share misinformation, provided that all other factors are equal, right? The other thing is that some people prefer sharing misinformation which masquerades as personal stories, and other people prefer sharing misinformation which masquerades as academic research. We provide, on the one hand, the tools which can automatically detect whether this is likely to look like a piece of academic research or a personal story, as well as whether a particular demographic group is more or less likely to share misinformation of this particular kind. And we do hope that you at the NHS will be able to use this kind of intelligence in order to target your communication better.
So it seems like these kind of tools have been available to marketers, digital marketers, for a long time. We've seen the likes of Cambridge Analytica utilize these tools in very unethical ways. Of course, us working in the health service, we need to be a lot more ethical in our approach to micro-targeting, how we, you know, go about utilizing some of the information that you have. Do you see any hurdles or barriers to implementing such tools as we apply them through our communication teams in the health sector?
I remember when we were discussing about bringing together our second workshop with our new lot of funding, we discussed at length whether we should actually bring in people who were subject to misinformation or who believed in conspiracy theories, who actually were the people who would spread the misinformation. But we also realised that if we did, what was likely to happen is that messages which we had picked up and said, that is misinformation, they were very likely to say, no, that's information. And we would actually just end up down a rabbit hole of discussing that. So we decided at that point that what we were going to do was to include people who were community leaders and who could represent various different groups, but not necessarily those who were susceptible to misinformation. And what we would discuss was the kinds of things we were seeing on the net, on Twitter and Facebook and Telegram, and we would discuss how people felt about those themselves and how they felt that the community was reacting to these things. So, you know, we saw that there were things masquerading as academic research, and there were particular discussions around vaccine hesitancy, for instance. We asked people to discuss that. That helped to inform the things that we were looking for when we were looking at messages online. It fostering public engagement, I think, to a large extent, we start to actually smooth out a lot of the ethical concerns, because we are actually talking to people all the way through the process. We're listening to what people are saying, and we are including what they're saying in the way that we're researching. There's two sides to this coin, but I think by fostering as much public engagement as possible and by considering these issues in depth before actually going ahead, I think to some extent we cover a lot of the ethical basis.
So at this point, I'd like to bring in Dr. Ben Allen to talk about your experiences with social media. Some in the health service would say, let's not engage with this minefield. Should we ignore social media at our peril?
So I guess, what's the environment that creates misinformation and its lack of good information? So the aim needs to be, let's get as much good information out there as we can. It's not just about telling people stuff, it's about listening and modifying the message and clarifying. When that happens, I think we probably don't have anything else to talk about. We have to use all the channels that we have. So that could be the traditional channels of you know, TV, radio, newspapers, but it's got to be social media, because that's just a way that people engage with information. We need to basically use as many of these things as we can, because often the messages that I think some of the problems have often been is that I think there's a bit of a movement within a lot of this kind of health information is we have to stay on message and keep it simple. But then most people know that there's not many things that are actually simple. And so people don't buy it. And unless you're going to go into a bit more depth with the people who are really kind of questioning, you're going to lose them all. I think there's an interesting distinction here between social media that's just like, we could call it the Wild West, which is basically just, you know, Twitter feeds, people, Facebook feeds, all that kind of thing. Everyone's just throwing stuff out, you know, out there, and that's always going to happen. But there are ways of having a bit more of a contained, managed environment that allows people to speak their mind. There's often a bit of a community. It's often a bit managed. We can have discussion, clarification. They're the kind of environments I think that you could create really good information. And I think that would outcompete the Wild West.
Yes, I really like that. Your surgery has been quite successful in using online forums to engage patients in your community to seek information and support. Do you feel this model can help build a more trusted approach to healthcare information sharing?
The NHS, it doesn't have a mechanism for communication particularly, and GP surgery is far even less so. These little organisations, the only way you can find out information is if you ring up the reception and if you can get through. So when medicine's changing, the way practicing medicine's changing, when things like COVID rules are all changing, where's our place for people to go to find out that information? So we created a Facebook group where we invited all our patients to join it, and it's crept up to over this. I think 1,100 people now that are on it. We've got 8,000 population. So we use it for kind of information about the service changes. We're using it for asking people questions about, you know, what do you think about this? We're thinking about that, asking their views. It's also moved into an area which is around the fact that we just don't have enough health professionals for all the need that there is. People find it hard to have those one-to-one conversations. So how do we engage with lots of people at once? If I'm kind of having one-to-one consultations and saying the same thing over and over again to lots of people, I'm like, I just need to, like, I can just tell 1,000 people very quickly. So that becomes then a mechanism for being able to talk about this is how you might want to approach a bereavement. Or there was a family member, I think, who came. They wanted their dad to kind of start making healthier choices effectively. And had a conversation with them around, this has really got to be about them. It's got to come from them. It's got to be about giving them a vision of a different future. Everyone's going to have relatives that they want to live differently. So I just put a post about that. So yes, there's a way of engaging with lots of people all at once. I think it's been part of how we've improved the relationship with our patients, because we're not just like a phone line to get through to. We make videos, put long posts on there, put my name at the end, people reply and then I reply to them, and people are able to speak more freely when they can type it. They will say things that they won't say to me face to face because of the power imbalance, and it helps with that. So I think that collective engagement, listening, responding, reasoning, accepting, I think that's created an environment which is very positive, honest, and I think that helps define the relationship we have with our patients, like in the building, when they come, what they expect.
Thanks, Ben. As a clinician, do you feel social media can be a source for useful population health related data gathering? We often struggle with getting feedback from the public as to how well a particular change in the way services are being delivered are impacting them, whether these changes have actually led to improvements or not. Do you feel social media interaction data can provide a robust yet more agile alternative to traditional healthcare research methods such as focus groups and surveys? Would you say this methodology is more or less invasive than the traditional research methodologies?
I'm not sure how well it would scale up in terms of being able to get data across the country, but it's certainly in terms of my practice, you know, there's the official route and the GP survey that comes out once a year. It's sent to people very randomly, so you get a really good selection of people from different kind of ages and demographics. Whereas on Facebook, I'm aware that it's kind of leans more to, I think, 70% female, mostly people between 40 and 60. So yeah, you've got to bear that in mind. In terms of getting opinions, yeah, I could ask them, what are your opinions about whether we keep the door open or closed, and talk about the pros and cons, just say what you think. At one point, I asked them, what three words do you associate with our surgery? It was unbelievable. Not one person put anything negative. So about 30 or 40 people, and it was just so much positivity. So it's a great way to get some data.
Fantastic. Thank you. I think our university colleagues have opinions on this. Serge, is there something you'd like to say about the methodology?
What I wanted to say, I wanted to respond to Ben's comment about misinformation and grey areas, because the example I gave in the introduction, it was a research paper which talked about the instantaneous penetration levels for the effectiveness of face masks. And it ended up with a recommendation which was like, face masks provide marginal protection against spreading viruses, right? And then how you read this, marginal protection against spreading viruses, whether it is useful or not. And then after that, so you might have some people on social media arguing in favor of wearing face masks for all, or some other people calling them muzzles and rejecting their use. By necessity, it is quite often vague. But then what people want quite often, they want hard and fast rules. And then what emerges on social media in response, then some people take a stance, so that no, everyone takes a stance, and some people take a stance of this kind, and others take a stance of a different kind. And yes, definitely we will have, depending on the current position of the government, so for example, whether face masks are compulsory or not, you will have very, very different perception of what is misinformation. So then at some point, calling masks muzzles would have been countering the NHS message. And nowadays, it probably doesn't make much a difference.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Christine, you wanted to come in there?
Yes, it was more towards the end of what Ben was talking about engaging with people in Facebook and on social media and getting such wonderful positive comments back, and also tending to have a rather positive engagement with people. And I would argue that some of that is actually because you've actually got a community there. Almost all of them at some point or another will have seen you face to face. They'll know you. And that's not actually something that often happens on social media. So I think there's probably a lot of work to try to take such great practice as you've got there, but try to create that at a much larger level so that you've actually got that feeling of community and personal engagement. But then you've also got this situation of how do we create communities that are close enough that people are actually going to be slightly more respectful of each other and actually take that forward, because I think that's a really interesting way to look forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I think at an ICS level, if we were to scale up, you know, the kind of engagement that you have, Ben, I'm not sure how well it would be received if it was across the whole of the geography. But I think if the ICS supported individual surgeries like yourselves to build those community relationships that you cover, there's the citizens are much more likely to be a lot more engaged with the messaging, even if that messaging was coming from an ICS level, but then cascaded through GP surgeries and primary care. Ben, did you want to say something there?
I agree. I think creating the posts take time. When changes happen or things that we think people need to know, I know there's people all over the city who are writing the same messages ready to go on their Facebook groups, and it'd be great if that was done centrally. A group of like switched on people who are in practices, making a message that can then just be pulled into their own social media feeds.
I think one of the research questions that the Leeds University project posed, and maybe Suad, you might want to come in, is around the question of trust and the level of trust that people associate with people in positions of authority. The community that, Ben, you serve have a really strong level of trust. It's quite evident there, even though in a way there is an authoritative position that you have as a GP serving that community. But it's not the same kind of relationship that we're people start to mistrust authority when we talk about, say, politicians or national level edicts coming from the news, etc. Suad, would you like to comment a little bit about your research and what you've discovered from trust and how communities believe in different layers of authority?
Yeah, I think the topic of trust emerged when we conducted the citizen panel. I go back to the point that Christina was raised, that was a crucial part in our project to involve like the authentic involvement of people to create a balance between what we do with the artificial intelligence and with the real authentic involvement of people. So throughout the discussion that took place with so many participants from different parts of the UK, the public engagement stimulated rich discussions about the factors shaping the level of trust in health information. So the participants were pointing out to the impact and the influence of communities and social networks. And mainly the other point was that the impact of educational level on trust in information that they are exposed to. There's also like a topic that they were referring to is the digital literacy and how it plays a role sometimes in the issue of trust, age, beliefs, and trust in public communication of health information. So there's a lot of factors. It's kind of a complex component of factors that often foster mistrust in messages coming from the health authorities. So throughout the studies, the citizens' discussion about these issues related to trust, it's kind of informed our directions of the project and realized that the trust is really crucial. It's at the heart of misinformation.
Thank you. Thank you. We've come to the end of our session. Thank you all for joining us. There's a lot of key messages here that we'll take forward with us in the region. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aejas.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Aejas. Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to The Innovation Station, the podcast of the South Yorkshire and Bassett Law Innovation Hub. The Innovation Hub is a partnership between the Yorkshire and Humber Academic Health Science Network and the South Yorkshire and Bassett Law Integrated Care System. The Innovation Hub works to help the ICS identify unmet needs from across the health and care sector and support the adoption and spread of innovation which can help meet these needs. I'm your host, Aejas Zahid, Programme Director of the Innovation Hub.